Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Tell Them, a podcast hosted by The Masher in partnership with Transmission Roundhouse, generously funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation.
This series, we're shifting things around a bit, bringing you bold and unfiltered discussions around decolonising theatre.
Every episode, we'll be joined by amazing theatre makers from the global majority, discussing power structures, global influences,
what they do, how they do it, why they do it.
We're your hosts, Githika
and Beth.
And you are tuning into episode number 4. This podcast contains themes that listeners may find disturbing, triggering, or uncomfortable.
Hello, and welcome to Series 3, Episode 4 of Tell Them, with me, Beth Capilla.
And me, Githika Batu.
And today we're joined by Testament and Jay Zaventin Nakid, and we had a really free-flowing conversation. It just sort of...
We ran out of time.
Yeah, we
had to cut Testament off. How rude.
Just too many things to say. We first jumped into... identity.
We did.
And reclaiming parts of our heritage and how that sort of feeds into
our practice.
Work.
Yeah, as artists, exactly. We talked about that. We also then started to talk a little bit more about remodeling theatre.
Yeah.
Dreaming up a new model that feels, positive and serving artists and audiences.
What's really nice also is that, like, it wasn't just about dreaming. I think for both people in the room, like, these new models are actually already happening and
they're doing it.
Yeah, doing it. So that's really exciting.
We also dived into the terminology global majority and talked about whether that is helpful or a hindrance within the industry.
Absolutely. And I think all of these conversations feed into what it means to start decolonizing dramaturgy, what stories we tell and why, where do they come from? Enjoy.
Welcome. I have two awesome guests with us in the studio today. Well, one's in the studio and one's on Zoom, which is super exciting. So who are we joined by, Beth?
So first up, we are joined by Jay Zaventin Nakid, who is in Birmingham, coming to us from Birmingham, but is the Associate Director at Belgrade Theatre in Coventry, which are, they're just doing amazing work at the moment, and was previously Associate Director at Tobacco Factory Theatres in Bristol. Over the past 10 years, he has created and directed a wide range of theatre projects across the UK, as well as Rwanda, India and Vietnam. And Jay is also a dad and loves Star Wars.
Woo!
Still. I'm not sure if I do.
Force is strong in my family.
I know. Like, this is a year. I'm not sure if I'm going to vote Labour, and I'm not sure if I still like Star Wars.
Ooh, controversial.
Only Andor can bring it back for me.
And we're also joined by Testament, who sat right next to me. Testament is a multidisciplinary artist, a rapper, playwright, and a world record holding beatboxer. How cool's that? Fancy doing a bit of beatboxing?
Tell them!
Wild. Hey. Absolutely wild. Amazing. Thank you so much. They are most well known for writing Black Men Walking, which was produced by the Royal Court, Royal Exchange and Eclipse Theatre 2. You might have also seen his work, Orpheus and the Record Shop, which was on TV.
So, this is a question that we ask everybody that comes on the podcast, which is, what has inspired you this week or recently in your life?
I jump in. It's quite good timing, actually, because something pretty inspirational happened to me last week. So it's been a while since I've been able to get out and about and do the work on the ground. Do you know what I mean? Just due to the nature of the job, there's been a lot of strategy, a lot of that kind of thing going on. But I was fortunate enough to be able to start a project with a group of young people in a school. And the end result is to talk, you know, the goal is to talk about authority and policing and their feelings towards that. And we started our first session talking about power and what power means and the different ways we have power. And let me tell you, these young people are 13 and 14. And the way they were chatting about power and their observations, like, I was gassed. Like, you know, when you walk out of a session and or a space and you're just, you're like pumped from from the ideas, from the words that that young people give you. So, you know, some of these young people talking about power and structural power and the difference between structural power and the power you have as an individual, and that actually as a collective, as in lots of individuals, you have more power than a structure. And I was like, man, user 13 and user thinking like this. Mm-hmm. I think when I was 13, what I was thinking about is like GTA San Andreas and and chicken. Like, do you know what I mean? It was as simple as that for me back then. But so yeah, I walked out of that room like inspired that these young people are on crud and in the best way.
Amazing.
Yeah, man.
Gorgeous.
Wow.
Last week, I don't get out enough, basically. And I managed to get a ticket to see a Streetwise opera event at Bridgewater Hall in Manchester. And the book was written, the lyrics were written by Patson Joseph, who's a bit of a hero of mine in terms of actors. And I went along not kind of knowing what to expect. And then also it was a double bill. So you had the Streetwise Opera thing, which for those who don't know, Streetwise Opera gets people who are homeless, basically, and on the street to work with professional opera people and choreographers and directors and stuff. And that was really mad inspiring, this whole thing about being saved from drowning. It was really powerful, really spoke to me. And I turned up there, managed to blag a free ticket, turned up, and my parents were there. So that was lovely. And I was
Without you knowing?
Without me knowing. So I was yeah, of course my parents are there. Right, okay. Because I grew up in Manchester for part of my childhood. And then I saw Patterson Joseph, Nature Sancho and Me, which I find really necessary piece of work and really important piece of work. One part which really stuck with me where he talks about Ignatius Sancho, who was the first black Briton to vote back in, you know, Georgian times. And he talks about going to a black pub in London. You know, we're talking like 1700s, because there were a number of black pubs in London at that time. And the few, and Patterson kind of imagines what the music was like, and this sort of multicultural fusion between Irish music, English folk music, Caribbean music, African rhythms. And that's pretty much my DNA. So I got a bit emotional there, seeing a multicultural cast bring almost like snapshots of my heritage to life. And so, and then I sat in between, literally in between my mum and my dad. So I found that very inspiring. It's just a great night.
That sounds so cool. And Streetwise, that's what you're directing,
yeah,
right?
I'm doing the one in Nottingham.
Let's go.
Yeah, so come along.
It's a walk.
It's a different.
Yeah, yeah.
But like they've made a different one in each city.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be a totally different opera. But yeah, similarly, we'll have like, I think it's Women of the Windrush perform after it on the first night, and then the Ignatius Sancho piece on the second night.
It was dope.
Nice.
How about you, Kitka? What's inspired you?
So we have literally just recorded episode 3 this morning.
A peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, a little peek behind the curtain. But probably one of the guests that came on, which is Kane Husbands. I mean, both guests were amazing. But Kane, we had it like when we like switched off the recording and everything, we were just having a bit of a chit chat about the industry, life, the juggle between sort of like work and play. And they're just so positive. They're like, they have such a like beautiful, positive aura and energy around them. And with an outlook that feels like, yes, things are shit, but also like, what can we do? And like, how can we move forward in a healthy way? So that's what's inspired me. What about you, Beth?
So as part of research for a project around demolition in Birmingham, I spoke to someone called John Christophers, who's an architect in Birmingham, and he like left his sort of slightly corporate architect-y job to basically start his own project called Zero Carbon House, where he essentially transformed his own house into like a completely carbon neutral. Like he extended the house from like a 2-up, 2-down into like a 4-bed house, but did it all completely carbon neutral in terms of the material and the ways that he did it. And now has made it into like an education program and is building like this community network in his area in Balsall Heath of like basically doing lots of retrofitting of houses, but making it a community project. So like people get choice over how they want their neighbourhood to look and do it together. And I just like that's I find that really inspiring of going start you know with you and then build it out and out and out until your entire community is like on a path to something pretty incredible. So yeah, big up to Zero Carbon House in Birmingham.
Amazing. Super. I love the spread of inspiration, man. All from different places, but all kind of positive and hopeful about moving things forward.
Yes, definitely. Nice. Shall we move on to our first topic for discussion of the episode?
How important is the rediscovery of one's own history, culture, and language to you?
I find it is important. But like, how important? I guess it depends where you are at in your life. Because there's the sort of rediscovery implies that it's been lost.
Sure.
And it can be, but it depends who you are. Like where I currently live in West Yorkshire, soon African people of African heritage, so post-Windrush, are going to outnumber those of Caribbean heritage. So there's a different... So for my mum, who's Ghanaian, she's actually quite clear-sighted about what her heritage is. And that has slavery in it and colonisation. My mum's maiden name is Evans, despite being a very black woman, which tells its own story, but not the one you expect. Two Welsh dudes moved to Ghana and married two Ghanaian women, two Gar women, and they lived monogamous lives with those.
Happily
with
those.
Well, one of the men disappeared in mysterious circumstances, which okay. I think is the title of my fourth album.
Yeah,
that's a whole TV series waiting to happen. What happened to that Welsh brother? He just disappeared in the night one time, but the other one stayed and raised mixed race kids, and then intermarried and blah blah blah, and then you get to my mum's generation, and she's a black woman, so in some ways my heritage in some ways is quite clear. For other people, you know, there's a transit, the middle passage, you know, all of a sudden cuts that off, and it's like, oh, I think I'm gonna, you know, I've got, I'm meeting a friend later on who's just did a 21andMe DNA ancestry, and he always thought he was mostly Ghanaian, and it turns out he's more Nigerian than Ghanaian. And that's from through Caribbean heritage and stuff like that. So in terms of his DNA, etc. So there's a mystery there and a sort of an unpacking of that. And there's lots of things, I think, where in terms of my childhood, so in terms of where my mum comes from, my African heritage, I've got Yoruba and Brazilian and all kind of thing going on. That's quite clear. And I sort of use that as a power up. When, you know, like, especially when you're confronted with racism, sure. To be able to say, no, this is who I am. No, you're wrong. I know who I am. Therefore, I can fight back. And then even though my dad's white heritage, because I'm a mixed race brother, so and my dad's, like, Scottish, English, tiny bit Jewish, and knowing, like, what went on there, and my parents brought me up they didn't use the term mixed race or biracial. They told me and my big brother that we were harmony.
Hey, I love that.
Yeah, because they went to a support group for mixed race couples in North London called Harmony. And so, and my mum, every time we were pushing me around North London in my little pram, if she spotted a couple who were two different sort of cultural backgrounds, she'd go, oh, look, son, that's a Harmony couple. So we have this positive reinforcement that we had the best of both cultures, and to be proud of that and to celebrate difference and celebrate culture, and the Iranian neighbor who used to make us food and da 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 da. So when I started getting racism and getting shouted at, you know, I'm that generation where racists would literally wind down their windows and shout racist abuse at you on the way to school. You know, I was like, your bullets cannot defeat me. My wings are a shield of steel. What are you talking about? And you have to be old enough to get that reference. That's a cartoon reference from back in the day. So like, I was just like, I'm bulletproof. What are you talking about? I know who I am. So I was really grounded. I think it's very important. It shouldn't have to be important. But the times when I found it most is when I need that power up. But also, like, I think there's like the traditions that you learn, and then there's also the new history that we're writing as well, which is kind of even more important, because your history could be effed up, and it's like, okay, that's important to learn from, but then what next? So I think as a writer, I think, and as dramaturgs as well, you know, like you're helping people write new histories, new stories. And I think that is crucial.
Yeah, gorgeous. Mm. Jay, what about you?
Amazing.
How are you feeling?
For me, it's complex. So, you know, I'm a mixed race brother myself. So, and I grew up in circumstances. It's funny, I was thinking about this when I was in the shower this morning, and like there was a period of time when, like, I've, you know, growing up, and forgive my language, you know, when I was growing up, it was half caste. That's what I was called. And my mom, you know, my mom was a big, rest in peace, was a big advocate of kind of the arts and stuff, and always used to talk about the Big Man Ben's poem about, you know, what you mean about half caste, all of that. So that very early understood that term was not the right term that you use. So I've always used the term mixed race. That has always been what's kind of settled with me and tied to my identity. And then everybody started saying dual heritage, like a few years ago, and saying that. And up until, this will be a tangented conversation, but so pre-2019, when people were using this term with me, dual heritage, I'd actually, well, actually, no. For me, I feel like I don't have the duality of my heritage. I was brought up in Birmingham in a multicultural environment, you know, very mixed friends, but I lent on my background and my culture I got from my friends and the people around me rather than my family at the time, because I grew up with a majority white family. Mm-hmm. So I was the only person of colour in my entire family growing up. And that had its own weight, its own bearing. You know, my mom did the best that she could, but obviously, you know, she was a white woman and very much tried to teach me things, tried to do it. But, you know, being a young mixed race man, stepping into those shoes as a teenager, there was just certain things my mom couldn't provide for me. So, yeah. So for me, it's been a complicated, complex journey, and one that I'm still on, to be honest with you. So I reconnected with my dad in 2019. So I grew up not knowing my dad. My dad's from Trinidad Tobago. Came over here when he was eight, I think. I think he was eight when he came, but never. You know, him and my mom weren't really a thing. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I just happened, and we'll leave it say it like that. And they parted ways, and he had some stuff going on in his life that was quite traumatic, and it meant he left the country. And so I just grew up with me, my mom, and then my stepdad came into the picture. And my mom told me when I was nine about my dad. So it was the first time I knew about him when I was nine. And she told me that, you know, your dad's from Trinidad. He did this, 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 this. He told me what he did for work, and he'd left me this letter. That, wow. You know, he's written you a letter. He left for you when you're a baby. And, yeah, it's there for you when you want it. And then it was kind of like, and I don't mean in any disrespect to my mom in this, but it was kind of like, there's the letter, see you later.
Sure.
I never read the letter. She didn't know how to hold that conversation or that space for me, sadly. And what that meant is I just grew up, fast forward 20 years, with all the preconceived, colonized versions of what I thought my dad was. And all of that, I can't hide the sort of media influence portrayal of the narrative of being a mixed race parent with a single white mother. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, all these things of rejection, all these blah, 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 blah. You can imagine the kind of narrative I've built in my mind. Fast forward to 2019, I was actually working on a piece of theatre, a play called Revealed, which is all about fatherhood and all about the relationship between a grandfather, his son, and a grandson, and they own a yard shop, a Caribbean takeaway in Brum. And working on that show in 2019, really, it just opened it all up for me. Like, we were, you know, chopping it up with the cast and getting to all these revelations of what it means to be a dad. And after the process, I just kind of thought to myself, do you know what? I'm gonna read that letter, I'm gonna track it down, I'm gonna find it. Tracked it down, got the letter out, read it, and it was basically a love letter to me. So that kind of blew my mind in the first instance. It kind of dispelled all the thoughts I'd had. There was an address on there. I ended up going to the house, knocked on the door, no one answered. Ended up searching the name, the name Michael Downs. His surname's quite popular in Trinidad, so it was Plantation. So there's lots of people with that surname. Ended up being all my cousins and stuff, and it's mad. But yeah, tracked him down, called him, and we started talking. And then we ended up calling each other, and it's proper mad. I read the messages the other day, and it's just like, I think you're my dad. I think you're my son. Shall we call? Wow. It was like that clear. It's quite mad. Yeah, just putting myself back in that place. But then when we spoke, he told me that he was actually in Trinidad for his dad's funeral. Right. So he was saying to me, this is wild for him, that on the day that I've popped up, there's a soul that has left this realm of kind of existence.
Wow.
And then he explained to me that him, my brothers, I've got lots of brothers, had actually been looking for me, but hadn't had the right tools or the right means to find me. Like, my mom changed the name. They couldn't remember where their house was, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all these little gaps that kind of got filled. But we got talking about work, obviously. And he was like, what do you do for work? And I was like, I'm a theatre director. I make theatre. And he asked me, he goes, oh, I go to the theatre. What kind of shows do you do? What was the last thing you did? Tell me about that. So I started talking about this show Revealed, which was like an R&D piece, basically. So there was only two showings of it, sort of an afternoon performance and an evening. And yeah, I started explaining the plot. And he went, was it in Birmingham at the Mac on the 3rd of April?
No.
And I was like, yeah. And, you know, he was there. He watched it.
That is wild. Away.
My mind was blown. So yeah, my dad was in the same room that I was in when I was thinking about reaching out to him, watching.
Look at the universe,
show that triggered it. So it's pretty wild. And then, you know, from that, we built a relationship and got to know kind of, you know, I'd say that side of my family, the sort of Trinidadian side of my family, and spread all over the world, really. And the links are crazy. He ended up knowing through the writer of that show as well. And then a couple of other people in my circle know my brother. So it's really mad how close to my dad I've been. It's like three or four people away. That makes sense. You know, that's six degrees of separation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like that idea that through five or six people, you pretty much know anyone. And I just like, man, I was four people away from my dad. And that really blew my mind. And just pulling this all back to this question. So for me, there was this sense of after that moment, I felt like when people said dual heritage, I feel like I could say, okay, yeah, I am dual heritage, because I'm now in the process of understanding that side of my family and where everybody's from and where that comes from. Whereas before, for me, it was just genetics. It was just about the race, in the most literal biological sense. So it's been really a big shift for myself, my personal identity of how that sits within my soul. And, you know, I changed my name as well. So my name used to be Jay Crutchley, which was my stepdad's surname, and he married my mom. And before the birth of my daughter, me and my partner at the time wanted to make our own surname. So we created the first part of our name, which is Zarenti, which comes from two different words. And then my dad, after, you know, building a relationship with my dad after a few years, he's traced his heritage back on his mother's side, which I quite liked, that it came from the matriarch and the maternal side of the family. Mm-hmm. He's traced it back as far as he could go, which if he thinks anyway, predates the plantation, the Downs plantation.
Wow.
So, and there's this name, Lakid, which, you know, roots in Lebanon and Yemen, from these set of people in the army that moved to Yemen. I can't remember which army it was, but settled in Yemen. He found this officer's name on my mom's side of that name. So
is that like First World War,
I took
or?
That name to pass on to my daughter, you know, so I'm saving it for when she's having drama, when she's like 14, 15, she feels like the world's on her back or something. I hope it doesn't happen. But like, you know, I've got this whole speech prepared for a man about, I saw an infographic like years ago about, you know, like one of these things where it's got like your grandparents, grandparents, and it goes back. So it takes like, you know, in the last couple hundred years, like 400 or 500 people need to exist for you to exist. And that really sat with me when I was thinking about this name and how many people had to survive with this name in order for it to be alive now. Sure. And exist now and not be kind of rubbed out. So at some point, I'm going to have this big, deep conversation. Look at my like blue sky thinking about what parenting's going to be. But I'm going to sit down with my daughter and have this big, big speech about the power of the name and, you know, the weight and the power of the ancestors that have lived with this name to give her the strength. So for me, it's important. And for my own journey, I suppose. And understanding that more. And, you know, hopefully, I've never been to Trinidad and Tobago, and that's hopefully in the next couple of years, I'm going to go out with my dad and yeah, man, go home, I was going to say, but I've never been there. But I feel now I know that side of my family and the roots, so to speak, or that part of the route anyway. Mm. It feels important.
Incredible. And it sounds like for both of you, even after listening to both of you speak, that it's almost like knowing your heritage has been really important for, like, almost like not ammo, but like fuel for the soul and fuel for yourselves to go if things are getting tough or whatever. It's like, how do you know where you're going if you don't know where you're coming, where you've come from, type of thing. Is that right to
There's
say?
An element of that. I think that's 100%. It's also like, it's also, so like, I'm aware that I'm quite privileged in that, like, whatever, my parents are together still, and they both talk to me still as well. And they both got stories for days. And as my dad retired, you know, spent a lot of time trying to look up his ancestry, and there's a thing about identity, right? And I mean, it's the reason why, like, so much of the political stuff is kicking off on both left and right, identity politics. And these are the things that we go to when things get rough. You go to, like, who am I? What makes me me? How can I keep my head when everyone else is going crackers? We've just been through this economic thing again, and then people start getting pushed to think about identity, like, oh, Britain for the British, and sure, like, there's people in boats coming to take away our identity somehow, and it will change the identity of this country. But also, also for me, like, it's funny, when I grew up, I used to call myself, yeah, Harmony at home, and probably mixed race or dual heritage at school, but it's only in the last probably halfway through my life I started calling myself Black. Mm-hmm. But I became Black because I needed to be home somewhere. And actually I did find home with a lot of mixed race people, but actually I found home and home with people who were marginalized. But also I found Blackness in its ubiquitous sort of term to be at home, partly because I was being pushed into it the whole time. So I was like, yeah, all right then. Right.
Let me go.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I will be Black. If you're going to call me, all right, I'm going to do that. I'm going to embrace that. But actually, like, I was also brought up on the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel and all that. So actually, I'm a melting pot, and I'm proud to be so. But I'm also proud to be Black. So I think that's really interesting, because actually when things get shaky, I need to grab onto my identity as well. But the question is, does grabbing onto your identity mean othering other people? Because actually, in terms of rediscovering your language, rediscovering your history, all that stuff from the quote that you read, actually, it's probably the white majority that need to do that. Mm. Because in a lot of ways, people, the global majority, whatever, I don't know what term to use, we are forced to constantly consider who we are.
Sure.
Because we're being othered the whole time, even if we've grown up here, supported the same football team as you, rare. But actually, it's the majority that needs to rediscover, well, what is your language actually? Oh, your language is actually a melting pot of loads of different cultures. Okay, from when you were colonized by the Romans, and when you colonized other people and you stole language from India. Okay, you need to do your homework, Britain. What is your language? What is your culture? Oh, fish and chips were invented, like, partly by Jewish people and also by, you know, Spanish Jews and Belgian people and da da da. All right, so your national dish is actually, like, from created by immigrants. Okay. Yeah. So St. George was Syrian. Okay. You know, do your homework, because then you'll realise, actually, you're way more global than you realise. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of work, not just for myself as a brown-skinned man, but actually the white majority.
And for sure. Yeah. That's such a great point. And actually, because you touched on it there, Testament, about that term, don't know what term to use, global majority. It's one of our questions for the room, which is like, what does global majority mean to you? And is it helpful or is it a hindrance?
For me, like, it's the best we've got at the moment, because we're going through a period of real empowerment and realising, like, when I was taught at school, Black people were either enslaved or Martin Luther King, neither of which is me. And, like, part of my history has been enslavement, and part of my history is hip-hop. Like, hip-hop is my language, you know what I mean? It's my first language in terms of learning how to express myself. Again, it's, like, who's the global majority helpful for? Actually, I think it's more helpful for, it's for the oppressor that is most helpful in a good way, in an educational tool, to realise, oh no, we're not the majority in the world.
I find it empowering when I use it, when I say God, majority. I feel like, I'm the... Someone asked me, I was doing like this press thing for the last theatre I was working at, and I said something like, oh, it's great to have a global majority actor in like the forefront of the play. And then they were like, oh, can I just ask you what global majority means? And you mean as in white people are the minority? And I was like, yeah. And he felt really uncomfortable, clearly presented as a white man. And I was like, yeah. And I just went really quiet, let him take it in. And I was like, that's the first time I've used that term or been questioned about it with somebody and really seeing the effects of the power of language that they have created. What about you, Jay and Beth? What are your thoughts on, is it a hindrance or is it helpful?
Yeah, it's interesting. I agree with a lot of what yous are saying about the empowerment of it. Like, I can't remember her name, I'm sorry, there's a disservice here, but I'm sure it was a professor in Leeds that wrote the paper that coined the term. Because remember, we were looking into it, when was it? Would have been like 2021.
And it was to do with youth work, wasn't it? It was to do with like, it was that again? Professor was doing youth work at the time, and it was connected to working with young people.
Yeah. And I always find it interesting with terms that start off as empowering, and sort of the idea of, you know, we spoke a lot about reclamation at the moment, aren't we? And refinding, and to terms that become like this, but then almost become a term for use of a better phrase, let's say the oppressor of an homogenous term, so they don't have to think about it, and they can just say, oh yeah, it's this, everybody that is, you know, what they would traditionally say is non-white, and I did quotation marks and a head wobble for those that can't see me. just to throw the point across, it becomes sometimes it can become a replacement for that. So that's my only thing with it becoming a hindrance, is I feel like there's been a cycle of language that, you know, we reclaim something, or how we talk about ourselves, I suppose. And then it gets used as a term, as a homogenous, that's the right word, isn't it? Homogenous term to call everyone in that context, oh yeah, there's the word, that's what we need to use.
So I'm
a walking contradiction, so I sit with it like that, because I feel empowered when I say it. Like, I'm part of the global majority, man. Like, there's bare of us. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that's an empowering thought, when actually you think about living on this little island and people chat to you the way they chat to you, and and you say these things, and it does make people sit a little bit uneasy. And I'm like, welcome to life. I can actually, you know, you had 2 seconds of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, welcome to life.
I can actually start seeing that tipping point start to tip slightly, because I'm hearing, like, I've heard white leaders say GM artists, and I have even sometimes gone GM art. You know, like when I'm writing, if we're
genetically
like
doing modified
stuff. Yeah, well, exactly. And I think it was Pooja, our artistic director. I'd put it in an email, and she was like, "What the hell's a GM artist?" And I was like, "Oh, it's short for global majority." She was like, "Don't start doing that."
Yeah,
because if you start doing it, it makes it okay for other people.
It's also, are we saying like global majority artists or artists from the global majority? Because I think when you put it in front of the person, you're basically going like, that is the thing that defines them, rather than saying an artist from the global majority means they are from a, you know, I think there are nuances even within the way it's used. Yeah. And I'm also mixed race, Indian and British, and I also, like, I don't know if I feel like I am global majority, because being of multiple heritages, I don't know if I am of, like, a lot, like, if I
what
can claim that
of
thing.
You is majority?
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm also partly white. So it's kind of, where do I sit within that? I feel like, I don't know if I do. But I think it's better than, I guess, BAME.
But don't forget, though, at one stage, that was the language we used and we were comfortable with, and we were like,
it reminds me of so many times when a charity has been working with a specific group, and then they've changed the name for that charity, and then it had become a playground insult, and then the new word that they can't term that becomes the new playground insult. I find that challenging. Also, like, global majority signifies, you could say that signifies that I'm not European. I'm no longer European. I'm no longer British. It could give that connotation. So is it in one way it empowers me, and I feel like, yeah. Another way it's like, oh, you're saying I'm I'm one of them from over there. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Because actually, when I go to Ghana, like, I, you know, I'm giving my auntie cuddles and all that and eating fufu and it's great, but it's just not my home. And, you know, I was a kid brought up singing, listening to African folk tales, and then also, you know, reading the scripts of Monty Python in my toilet. Do you know what I mean? Like, so I had both things going on. So, and yeah, and part of me, which is really perverse, thinks still, like, when someone says we won the World Cup, part of me thinks, is that part of me? Did part of me, my heritage, win the World Cup? Is that part of my identity? I don't actually care that much about football, so it doesn't really count. But but you know what I mean? Yeah. We did this. Oh, Britain, we really need to sort out our policy on this and this. And I'm talking about my country. And, you know, Shakespeare is part of my heritage. Which, you know, is cool. That's one cool aspect. Slavery is also part of my heritage, both as the enslaved and the enslaver. Mm. So the global majority... And there's a whole thing as also, like, if you're from a traveler Roma community, that you're not included in global majority.
Yeah.
Even though obviously lineage goes back to North India. Mm-hmm. But like, you know what I'm saying? So it's complex. But it's the best we got for now.
Mm.
Just reminded me, there was an amazing artist I worked with a few years ago, and as part of the process we were working on, this woman actually Miranda, and she was mixed race she is mixed race, and was talking about the line, it's always stuck with me, the line that she wrote, which is how, can't remember what the prefix of the line is, but something, when you're both colonized and colonizer, talking about her identity and how that sits in your body when those two narratives exist hand in hand. As it's interesting as you say that, as that's, you know, what counts as part of you when both those things are true. And especially, you know, if you talk about ancestral trauma and what's passed on through genes and what's passed on through DNA, when those two things exist in the same body, what then? I don't have an answer for that. That's a new thesis that's about to go down, but that's an interesting thing, because there is, and I won't be able to quote any of the research or anything like that, so apologies, this is probably a slightly uninformed take, but there is, you know, I know there is reading out there about it, about that stuff living in DNA, and that it's you know, it's a physical biological thing that those things happen, and understanding the nature versus nurture, all of that stuff, and what sits in us, you know, through the ages.
It's really hard. I can remember teaching a youth whose father was a criminal of some of the worst crimes that you can imagine, insert worst crime here, and therefore this lad who was a young offender, it was like, oh, I'm destined to do this because this is what's in my DNA, you know, there's horror in my DNA, therefore I have to perpetrate it. And I know that is an extreme example, but like taking that as a parallel or as an allegory for us, it's like, well, how much are we connected to that? And I think, you know, like I said at the beginning, it's like, well, you're going to learn from, you're going to take inspiration from something, or you're going to say, well, I'm not going to be a bad person like that ancestor was. One of the things I'm writing is I've got this idea for a horror film, and it's all about generational trauma, because I've got trauma on both sides of my family, and both the white side and the black side of my family, for want of a better term. Colonization has affected the white side really badly, and also the black side. And I'm still dealing with the results of that today. So I think there's something about creating a new language, which probably is one of the reasons I was drawn to hip hop. And a lot of my Asian brothers as well, you know, like, well, where I lived in Manchester, when the period of my child in Manchester, I used to roll with, yes, black kids, but also a lot of South Asian kids too, and we were all into hip hop, and it was a way, and Bruce Lee obviously, but it's finding those ways into going, well, where's my hero, who's going to be my moral leader, and hip hop was a way of creating language and was my way into the arts. So, and global majority is an, also a new language, and sure. we're sort of groping around looking for ways to read to write a future for ourselves, right?
Absolutely, and that's such a gorgeous segue onto the next question, actually, about writing a new future and discovering a new way if the old way is not serving us. And the question that we want to talk about is about if we were to dream up a model for theatre, what would that look like?
Which I wonder whether if we start with Jay, just because I know that like that's a lot of the work that you're doing in your role as associate at the Belgrade. It feels like you're all sort of undertaking that question in your work every day, which is really exciting.
Yeah, it is. And I don't think I have a solid answer. I'm going to make that clear of what I think it is. I suppose what I have is an opinion and an informed sense of the people that have come before me at the Belgrade and everything that they have put in place in order for us to do the work that we're doing now. And it really is about this co-created approach. And when we talk about co-created, it's a term that gets used, I think, now, but used in a way which is it's potentially slightly shallow. And I don't think that's any fault of anybody's word, but it's become the standard word we mean for just working with young people or working with a community group. You say, oh, yeah, this is co-created. Mm-hmm. But what do we actually mean by that? We can collaborate, let's say. Like I might be collaborating with a group of young people. What does co-creation actually mean? And in the way we talk about it, it's from the point of inception. So it's trying to subvert the model of this is the power structure. We have this offer. What do you want to do? Because already there's a bias and already there's a allocation of power that already takes the co-creation and is being driven by the party with the perceived power, let's say. Uh-huh. So the models we're trying to really work is how can we create organic approaches so that we're just out and about with people and there's no agenda. So we're in community spaces, we're just at events, and we're not there to poach a project. We're not there to grab onto something, but we're there just to be. And if people talk to us, they talk to us, and trying to understand people, places, understand what people are saying, doing, wanting. And then if someone's like, something theatre, then I'm like, okay, what do you mean? And we can follow that nose. But that's not easy to do within the funding structures that we have in this country. So, you know, we can't just say, oh yeah, we're just going to listen. But what do you actually mean? There was a time, just personally, if I step out of that for a second, in my career where, you know, I spent the majority of my career being out and about, and I didn't really care about traditional theatre, making shows. I was just about making the work in the places I was making it. F theatre, F the institution, very much throw a rocket, yeah, see you later. But got to a stage where, you know, I'd meet these talented young people or this someone that had a spark and had no network to send them into. I had to make a switch in my mind anyway of then, you know, that wasn't counted as experience. I suppose that's the point I'm trying to make. So I applied for like an assistant director job or something, and it'd be like, it's not the right experience. Even though I've got 10 years of practice behind it, not the right experience. Cause I wasn't in that traditional space of what, you know, what I'd call a director facilitator. But actually now what I'm finding fascinating is that's what everybody wants you to be, is to be able to facilitate, is to be able to do that work. But what's, in my opinion, and no offense to anybody, what's missing is the practice of that. So in my opinion at the moment, and this is just my personal opinion, this idea of co-creation, of how it's used in the wider sector, is used as a stepping stone to traditional work. So we do young people, we do community stuff, and then we graduate to having a show, a proper show. Mm. And it's like, nah, man, that the stuff you're doing and claiming as part of a journey is practice.
Yeah.
Send me to a community centre with two people. That has as much value to me as, I don't know, someone might place on what they would call a main house show. It's about the people and how we serve the people, and especially the people of Coventry and then the people of the Midlands.
Jay, what absolute... We need to have tea. The kettle is on. Jasmine tea bags, let's go. I was thinking about that question, and pretty much that's exactly what I was going to say.
No way.
I gave a talk about... was it last year, last July? To the AMA conference, which is like Arts Marketing Association. And they asked me to do a talk about the power of story. And I basically was like, oh, all right, fine. But actually what I really want to say is you need to be out there talking to people about their lives. And like, it's not, you know, you're trying to sell stuff to people, but actually you don't even know who they are. Mm-hmm. Even the big capitalists have got the insight to go, you know what, do people really need a Hoover with golf clubs, to quote Ty? You know what I mean? Like, so what is the thing that you're manufacturing? And actually, if you are creating a piece of art, who is it serving? And what good is it doing in society first? And if the flipping, you know, the evil corporations of this world are thinking like that, we should be way further along and then going, oh, we need another, oh, can we do Henry V again?
Oh, God.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
well,
do you know what I'm saying?
It's interesting, and Corey can speak more on this, so I'm going to paraphrase stuff that he's told me and from our conversations. So Corey Campbell, being creative director of Belgrade Theatre, but speaks about, you know, co-creation, and co-created is a capitalist term, and it comes from big manufacturing companies doing surveys on what people wanted from their products. So it's interesting. It has roots from that, from what you're talking about there.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like being a spiritual being, like, theatre finds its roots in religious traditions all around the world. You know, whether that's the griots of West Africa or whatever, there's loads of theatrical stuff which has come from spiritual traditions, which is about community and about bringing people together, meeting needs as a community. And if actually we can decolonize and go back way beyond before pre-capitalism, you know, and take inspiration from there, and where it is about sitting around the fire together and sharing stories, and then, okay, how are we going to share this story in a different way? Or is it even about the product as well? Uh-huh. It's just really hard because as an artist and as a freelancer in particular, like, I'm on a little hamster wheel, right?
Yeah, so, of course.
I've got three kids, you know what I'm saying? So, like, on the one hand, so I'm trying to balance, like, doing shiny things, flipping, writing for Netflix and stuff like that one day, and then going into a primary school or a prison, you know, the next week, you know what I mean? And it's, you know, I enjoy both, but like, and actually the good thing about like having shiny things to say is that like you can use that to win over a room of young offenders and go, oh yeah, what have you done? Have you met anyone famous? Well, I met Gittica once. She was cool. Do you know what I mean? It gives you that license to be able to like encourage someone, or, you know, so if you give them a thumbs up on their writing, they'll listen to you a bit more because you wrote for some multinational once. Uh-huh. Do you know what I mean?
Do we think then that funding, like, because you were talking, Jay, then about like funding applications, and that you guys are blessed, but also not blessed. You've worked hard to get funders to buy into what you're doing and see the value in it. Does funding and the shortage of resource have an impact on how hierarchy plays, and how, you know, if there are more artists like you guys who want to look at models of working like this, how can we do that without funding? Do you know what I mean?
Right now, they will give money for some things, like, but still, like, but even like on an educational level, the schools that, you know, you don't do drama. So there's going to be a massive gap of British actors soon, and or unless you're a nepo baby or your mummy and daddy can afford to like take you to extra training, or we'll pay for you to do 2 years at X drama school. So I think there's a whole thing of a priority. Mm. So hierarchy makes people retreat into those. Lack of money does make people retreat into the inverted commas tried and tested, like, old forms. It makes people not want to try out new things, right? Because there's not much money to go around. Whereas actually, it's an investment. When kids do drama at school, when communities are being resourced, you know, when there's more community happening, less mental health problems, more productivity in the workplace, if you want to go that way. So it's actually, you're cutting off your nose to spite your face, which I think I know what that means, but anyway.
I know what you mean. And I think there's a couple of things around, like, the lack of... The retreating of like funding arts in schools has meant that then the money that could be that pot that's there for just like the broader arts is then like using some of that to basically supplement what should be the education budget, like money coming from the education department into schools. So again, it's sort of cutting that pie even smaller for the bigger arts pot, if that makes sense. Mm. So money's being diverted that could be spent on more, like, more community-centred work or just, you know, other sort of arts work. So that's, I feel like that's a really big thing. Like, the education department need to be investing more in the arts. I think more, like, hyper-local, long-term arts spending.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, you know, I resonate with everything that's been said. Like, you know, we see the grassroots value of art and what it does for people on that micro level. I think a big part of the problem is a philosophical one that starts with the government and the way the government are chopping their budgets and the way government are creating language and terminology around art and what art is doing and what type of art they're placing value on. And I wonder, and this is a genuine thought process, the question, like, is it, you know, I know what I'm about in terms of where I stand with making work and where my money should go, but working for an organisation within buildings and having to understand the strategic side of things more from having, you know, in a space where there's bricks and mortar, it's like, do these big, as we've, the phrase we've been using, these big shiny projects, these big shiny things, keep the lights on in order to do the other work. And then I wonder if there's a level of the big national shiny projects that draw focus to theatre and to art for investment from top-level government.
I agree.
So is there a level of appeasing at the highest level in order to get the funding, the kind of minimal middle management of arts funding and the buffer between government and how then arts money is spent, but there's just pressure. There's just pressure to keep their lights on. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Pressure to keep their lights on in order to distribute the money. So yeah, I think it's interesting and complex. And if you want to build a better future, then it's about doing what, in my opinion, doing what you can do with the resources that you have in your immediate surroundings. In this position now, I feel a burning desire, you know, this was, to be blunt, was part of the Game of Thrones for me. Was like, you know, as a when I talked about that shift earlier of going and moving from, you know, I needed to find a way to get resource and network so I could support the people I was working with, and now find myself in the kind of work that I'm in. And actually it becomes about, okay, how can I utilise what we have here at the Belgrade to serve artists in the best way that we can with the resource that we have. We can't be everything to everybody. Yeah, and, you know, that's a hard truth, and that's not a cop-out either.
I hear all of that, Jay, and I think what is dangerous and can get dangerous is, I mean, part of the work that we're doing with the Masher with Shift is speaking to venues up and down the country, across the regions, a lot of them being white-led organisations. And because this is a topic that is on everyone's minds, everyone has to do those shiny shows, everyone has to put bums on seats to make money, it is a business, all that stuff that we all know. It seems to be that actually that thing about serving local artists and global majority artists especially seems to be so low on priority lists. It's almost like making money is up here and pointing up, and then global majority artists sit on the bottom in terms of priority lists. And I think when we talk about it, it just, you guys and what you're doing at the Belgrade is so inspirational, because you just said then we're doing what we can with the resource that we have. And I think that's important. It's not about picking which box you're going to try and serve this year, the queer box or the race box. It's all intersectional, and that's super important. I'm really sorry we're going to have to stop.
Yeah.
Can I just say one thing? Like, it doesn't...
I've got one thing to say.
Sometimes it does... Yeah, it'll be really short. Sometimes it doesn't have to be either or. Sometimes I saw Tanika Gupta's Great Expectations at Royal Exchange. Loved it. Kind of thing that people like my mum and dad would go to see, or just any random silver-haired ninja would go to see. But you're also telling a hidden history of India and colonialism at the same time. There are projects, yes, like Black Men Walking was an example. We sold out two national tours on this show about blackness in Britain and walking. It was dope.
Yeah. Jay, go on.
It's exactly what I was going to say. So I'm glad you said it in a probably more articulate way that I was going to say. But exactly that. And I think that's, just to go back to our co-creation model, that's what we're trying to do with that. Yeah, man.
Brilliant. Nice. Thank you both so much for this conversation.
It's a shame we didn't have a full day, because I think we would have had a full day with other content.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thanks, guys. We're going to sign off. Make sure you stay tuned for our next episode of Tell Them. Reach out to me. If you love this episode, then please do share it with your friends and maybe even leave a cheeky review.
And for more of Tell Them, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on our socials for episode drops.
Join us for episode 5. We're going to be chatting with Millie Battier and Mojisola Adebayo.
Tell them!